It is Friday, February 14th, 2020. Happy Valentine's Day, all you lovers out there. My name is Daniel Bader. This is the Android Central Podcast. And we are back from Unpacked. I have not actually unpacked. If you look at the floor below me, I'm still... Everything that I brought with me is still strewn everywhere, which is exactly what I do every time I go away. Wow. Andrew, what about you? Have you unpacked?
I have unpacked for the most part anyway. I don't know if I've mentally unpacked, but I've at least dumped the suitcase into the dirty clothes.
You haven't mentally unpacked because we don't have the phones yet. And
no.
That's a difference from last year, but we'll talk about that in a second. So, Andrew, this is Andrew Martinick, in case you haven't heard nearly every podcast that we've recorded over the last couple of years. Andrew is a recent transplant to New York, which is kind of cool.
We're getting podcasts from the same time zone. It's weird.
I know. It's 8:58 a.m. when we're recording.
Yeah. This would be way too early if I was still at home.
I guess we could disclose why we're recording so early, because you're going somewhere to pick up a thing that you've been looking forward to, right?
Yeah, I get to go pick up a Galaxy Z Flip in a matter of hours, which is pretty amazing. Unfortunately, there's a caveat on it that it's being picked up from Samsung, and I have to then return it to Samsung within a day, which is fun. I guess.
So that stipulation seemed weird when they said it to us back in San Francisco. And then last night I was up late doing some work, and I noticed that everybody around midnight was trying to buy the Z Flip and couldn't because there was no stock. And Best Buy sold out within minutes. Apparently some stores only had like 5 or 10 units, and Samsung.com didn't have many units either and sold out pretty quickly. So my guess is just that they're asking for it back because they really just don't have that many units to sell people.
Yeah, and the implication there isn't that they're going to package these up and sell them, of course, just to be clear. But, you know, they have lots of other, you know, people and marketing needs, et cetera, that actually need these devices. And I have a feeling that when Samsung hands out all of these devices to journalists, that they themselves, as marketing and PR people, will not have devices left over for, you know, their own uses either. So I, from that perspective, I kind of get it. And I do understand that there's some tight stock out there, I think. I would be shocked if they made more than, you know, what, 50,000, 100,000 of these things for the entire world right now?
Yeah, I think they're hedging quite a bit, given that the Galaxy Fold failed miserably before it went on sale. So they're probably like, listen, let's make a very small number of these, wait until our early adopters come back to us with impressions and see if we should ramp up production. Now, just like saying it off the bat, this does not look like it'll be anywhere close. In fact, it looks like it's going to be the opposite to what happened with the original Galaxy Fold. That's a great thing. The first impressions here have been universally positive, especially when compared to the Motorola Razr, which was released last Friday.
Rough timing for Motorola.
It just has been like panned. We have our review up on the site now. We were one of the first to review it, and slowly trickling in has been The Verge, Wired, Droid Life, like all of the sites that you'd expect to review a brand new foldable phone have just like excoriated this product. Like it's kind of embarrassing actually for Motorola, because the first impressions I had of it were quite positive. But there was always this lingering feeling in the back of my mind, like, I know that once I get over the wow factor of the fact that this thing folds and there's this teardrop fold that, you know, prevents a crease and all that, and there's this nostalgia factor, it's still going to be a pretty mediocre Motorola phone underneath it all.
Yeah, and I don't think that, I mean, as far as I remember, you weren't alone in your initial take being very positive, but I think that as people had more time to think about it and obviously review it, they found out that, yeah, all of these things that we inherently knew about it just kind of being a mediocre Motorola phone underneath came to roost when you actually started using it, and the camera was horrible and the processor obviously wasn't up to speed to the price you were paying here, which is $1,500. And that really ingenious hinge that I and everybody else, I think, praised it because it slid the screen and, you know, did a lot of interesting things to prevent creases, actually meant that the screen itself was very unstable, bumpy? I guess you would say.
Like, it was lumpy. It was bumpy. It was basically like an 89-year-old man's face is what you can say. Like,
wow,
it was
okay.
It's not a, like, if you look at a phone normally, right, you don't really see any breaks in it unless it's physically broken. But on the Razer, now that we've kind of had some time to look at it closely, because the layer is plastic and because the unlike the Fold, the hinge forces the screen to physically move every time it opens and closes, the layer is physically changing places whenever you're moving it. And
so
that
it's anchored at the top and then slides on the bottom, like in and out of the chin, I believe,
right,
is the way it works.
It reminds me a little bit, like in retrospect, of the BlackBerry Storm. Like, we were talking last week about the end of BlackBerry Mobile.
Oh.
You know, the end. But I mean, just remember, like, the BlackBerry Storm was not a capacitive touch device in the same way that like an iPhone or the Galaxy, the early Android phones were, like the G1 and stuff. Like, this was a phone that was basically you press down and it had four areas that were taking pressure input rather than it being like a capacitive touchscreen. Anyway, not at all the same thing, but I'm just saying, like, it feels a little bit like Motorola was hiding this fact in plain sight, and it knew that once the phone was released and people had a bit more time to scrutinize the design, this would eventually come out. And it's interesting that the phone was originally supposed to come out in January, and they would have had a way longer lead time against the Z Flip than the 8 days that they had eventually.
Yeah.
And that was so much more damaging to the Razer's potential sales numbers, because not only was the Z Flip announced and then released 3 days later, but it is $120 cheaper and it is objectively better in almost every way.
Yeah, I think that was the most stark thing to take away from using the Z Flip, just a few days after using the Razer. And I wasn't at the original Razer launch event, so my only take was just recently. And contrasting the two, you just see how far ahead Samsung is in just hardware fundamentals, I think you would say, in terms of just the build quality of the entire thing is just the same build quality as a Galaxy S10, but it just folds in half. And just even before we get to the screen, which is probably, you know, which is really the nail in the coffin for the Razer compared to the Z Flip, just the fact that there's proper internal specs, Snapdragon 855 Plus and 8 gigs of RAM, 256 storage, like cameras that actually work properly, just like all of the basics around the phone, and it's still cheaper than the Razer, is pretty crazy, because you could see all of the compromises that Motorola had to make, and you fully expected it, because look, it's the first phone released to do this, you know, clamshell folding form factor versus this larger tablet type thing, like the Galaxy Fold. And so you were willing to give it a break on some of those things. And then Samsung comes out and is like, no, really, you shouldn't have to give up on all of those things. You can just have like a normal, basically last year's flagship phone, and that it also folds in half.
So what's interesting is the Flip uses foldable glass, and it's the first phone to use that. But we know that it's not from Corning. Corning has been teasing the fact that it's been developing a foldable glass substrate for many, many years, but it has not released it commercially. And we were thinking maybe Samsung just slid this under, you know, the radar and used Corning's glass for the first time. But no, in fact, Samsung invested in a company, a small company from China, that was making foldable glass prototypes and eventually was able to make it consistently enough and of high enough quality that they bought a majority share in the company and then started using it for the Flip. And it's interesting because we obviously it's out today. It's February 14th. So we don't know how it'll hold up over the long term. But just the fact that Samsung claims that this thing can do 200,000 opens and closes, and the fact that you don't have to worry about like digging your nail into it and permanently damaging the screen, is just a massive, massive leap forward. And something that obviously in a year or two we're going to have taken for granted. But this is major. It stands in direct contrast to the Razr. And this is, I think, a very exciting product. The other thing that's interesting is Samsung learned its lessons from the Fold. And this phone benefited so much from the mistakes of the first Fold design, yeah. Right? There's a bezel that runs the around the display to protect the screen covering, this glass. And inside the hinge, there's also this sort of, it's basically like a broom.
Like a push broom of like little bristles to keep, that moves when you move the hinge to keep dust from getting in it when the hinge is between open and closed and, you know, would have an opening for things to get in it.
So my question is, do you think this was part of the design originally, or it was retrofitted to the Z Flip after the original Fold had its problems?
I think the latter. And I think that the specs of this device indicate that it was originally expected to launch several months ago as a kind of TikTok 1-2 punch with the Fold earlier in the year. And then when the Fold had its problems and they spent their time getting that back, I think that they then, you know, rolled that stuff forward into the Flip as well. I mean, you can see that the hinge and the styling and the hardware follows the Fold very, very closely, but it obviously works in a different way, especially when the hinge itself, I mean, the mechanics from what they showed us seem very similar, but the hinge is by design extremely tight. So the way they designed this is not to click closed and click opened and be kind of sprung in between. It's one of these like infinity hinges or whatever you want to call it, like on the kickstand of a Microsoft Surface, where you can set it to any angle you want and it stays there. It doesn't attempt to close until it's down to maybe 10 degrees. And it doesn't attempt to be stuck open until it gets to about 170 degrees. So I think just the tightness of the hinge in itself tells you that it's been worked on and redesigned since the Fold.
Yeah, I'd imagine that's true. I mean, let's go over the specs before we move on, because you mentioned that it was probably meant to come out last year. The specs bear that out. What's inside the phone?
So it's a Snapdragon 855 Plus versus the 865 that's in the S20 series. And then you get 8 gigs of RAM, whereas everything else now is using 12, which is insane. 8 is fine. Interestingly, you actually get 256 gigs of storage rather than 128 in the S20 series. And then the cameras, by my understanding, are just the standard and the ultra wide from the S10 series.
Right.
And the selfie camera is no different either. Although it's not the same selfie situation as the Galaxy Fold, because they just went with a regular hole punch single camera on this rather than that big notch. And they dropped the time of flight sensors on the front and back, which, you know, were fully useless on the Galaxy Fold anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it's a simple phone, right? If you think about it, uh-huh. other than the fact that it folds vertically, it's a pretty simple device, right? There's no, Samsung is not outfitting this with 2020 style features, right? It's not going for a bigger camera sensor.
And I don't think it has to have that. It's Samsung's leaning really hard into the design and the fashion of this whole thing, which makes sense compared to the Galaxy Fold, which was like, this thing is a giant brick, and so we filled it with, and it's expensive, so we filled it with every possible spec.
Right.
In this case, this thing is $20 less than the Galaxy S20 Ultra, which, you know, in its own right is a brick. But it's like saying, okay, you can get the S20 Ultra giant phone, traditional smartphone with all the specs, or you can get for basically the same price, the Z Flip, which has this very novel design and like, you know, head turning look, but it scales back in the specs a little bit. I think it's a good 1-2 punch, even though they clearly didn't attempt in the first place to launch them at the same time.
So my question is, I know the answer if somebody's deciding between the Moto Razr and the Z Flip, but if somebody's deciding, okay, I want to invest a lot of money in a phone right now, and I want this new foldable form factor, should I buy the Z Flip or the Galaxy Fold? Which one would you recommend?
I think the Z Flip all day. And it purely comes down to this glass covering that you don't have to be so worried about all the time. Whereas the Galaxy Fold, the Moto Razr, every other foldable up to this point, just incorrectly digging your fingernail into it or dropping something of any size or weight onto it when it's sitting open could, you know, irreparably damage the screen. And that's just not going to be the case on the Z Flip. And that's it, just like that peace of mind makes a massive difference,
right?
Between, I mean, to say nothing of the crazy difference in form factor, you know, I'm excited to, like, I still haven't put the Z Flip in my pocket. You know, I don't know how this form factor is going to work in that way, but I know that the Fold doesn't work in that way. It's way too big.
And it's ungainly, and that 4.6-inch display on the front is kind of useless. Like, there's so many things that now, months later, we can look back and say, okay, this is very much a V1. Samsung will improve it. Look at exactly what they just did with the Flip. So, and it's cheaper, and ultimately, I think you'll have a better experience. There are people who are going to come back to us and say, well, what about the bigger screen on the Fold? Isn't that the whole purpose of a foldable phone? And to them, I would say, try the Z Flip before you dismiss it, because I think you'll like it.
And that's what we're kind of going to try to figure out when I use this Flip is, you know, does this form factor make sense, or do we need to try and apply this foldable stuff to something more like the Fold? You know, a combination of the Z Flip's hardware with the Fold's form factor to get something a little thinner and lighter, but still a big screen. That's what we got to figure out. We don't know yet.
Okay, so let's move on, talk a bit about the Galaxy S20 series. So we've had three podcasts already talking a lot about it. Nothing has changed because everything that leaked was accurate. But now we've seen the phones, we've used the phones, we've taken some photos with these massive cameras. The Galaxy S20, S20 Plus, they're bigger, better versions of what we saw before. The S20 Ultra is really, really interesting. Walk us through why it's so exciting.
Yeah, the Ultra is the properly new phone because it is Samsung's biggest ever phone. It has a 6.9-inch display. And even though they redid the cameras on the S20 and S20 Plus, which deserve their own praise because they seem considerably better than the S10, they even did it one better and, you know, replaced two of the newest cameras with two more newer cameras on the Ultra. So it's the one that all the nerds are going to love, obviously, because it has a 5,000 milliamp hour battery, giant screen, and this 108 megapixel main camera and this 100x zoom telephoto camera, space zoom, as they call it, which is hilarious. And I'll never say space zoom ever again. Those big bullet points separate it so much from just the lineage of the Galaxy S series, which has been very, very tightly controlled, that I think that makes it really appealing. I still don't know if it's worth it. The thing is $1,400.
Yeah, it's more expensive than the Z Flip. It's like this brand new form factor that's way more expensive to produce. But no, here's a traditional phone that's $20 more. I see that and I'm like, okay, here are a few things that forced Samsung's hand to some extent. And by no means am I justifying the fact that the main S20 costs $1,000 up from $750 for the cheapest Galaxy S10, which was the S10e. But there are a few things that we learned in Hawaii when we went to Qualcomm's tech summit. One, the Snapdragon 865 is very expensive, considerably more expensive than the 855. And along with the 865, companies are going to be forced in some way to outfit the phones, especially in their flagship lineups, with the corresponding chips that support this phone. So we're talking about LPDDR5 RAM. We're talking about UFS3 storage. We're talking about these really complicated 5G antennas. We're talking about this massive camera sensor that takes advantage of all of the new Snapdragon's image signal processing capabilities. And that camera sensor in particular is really interesting. It is, to my knowledge, the largest camera sensor ever found on a phone. It's 1.33 inches, which, if you think about it, is significantly larger than the one in the Mate 30 Pro. It is bigger than the one in the Lumia 1020. It's coming close to the size of the 1-inch sensors found in things like the Sony RX100 series. So
yeah, it's 3/4 away there.
It's basically it's almost something that you would put in a real camera, and that is impressive. So,
and I do appreciate that. I mean, Samsung did what a lot of fans and pundits alike have been saying: give us the version, give us the phone or the version of the phone that doesn't care about price, doesn't care about thinness or lightness, and just puts all the things in it. And they really did that here, focusing on battery and camera, but also, like I said, all the specs that lay out there. I think the only issue with that is that because of all those chipset and radio and networking things that made this really, really expensive, they had to cheap out a little bit in other places where there's no headphone jack, even though the thing is gigantic. And there's only 128 gigs of base storage, even though it's $1,400. And they also are only including a 25-watt charger in the box, even though it's $1,400.
Yeah, I don't use the word unconscionable very often, but those two decisions are pretty unconscionable. Like, the fact that I don't care about the headphone jack, right? That was not a price-saving measure.
Yeah, that's more of a thing that I'm just trying to gain some favor with the fans.
Fair. You're acting for Jerry when he's not here.
Yeah.
Just for everybody's information, Jerry's fine. Advocate. He's just a bit under the weather. He'll be back next week. So, yeah, I agree with you. But I do think the base storage of 128 gigs is insane for a $1,400 phone. I think it is extremely cheap on Samsung's part. And it's actually odd if you think about it. Like, this is a company that was one of the first to move to 64 gig standard. It was one of the first to move to 128 gig standard. It was the first to offer 512 and 1 terabyte versions of its devices. And here we are with its most expensive traditional phone ever, and it's 128 gigs of storage.
And the Note 10 Plus has 256 base.
Right. And I mean, that's probably on purpose, right? It's like, okay, if you still want the productivity phone or whatever that means, we have a Note for you.
Sure.
I don't know. I'm just like, I'm trying to understand the reasoning here. Maybe they would have been forced to charge more for it or just eat the margin a little bit, which is a thing that Samsung said in its latest earnings report that it would need to do. Because it earned considerably less money from its mobile phone division than it has in previous years.
Well, and also you can see that they streamlined the lineup big time this year. Last year they had multiple storage options of all three models, and they had a separate ceramic model that was more expensive and had even more storage with all the colors and everything like that. This year the S20 has no options. It can't have any more storage or RAM. The S20 Plus can only have more storage. That's it. There's one option for 512 and no extra RAM. And the Ultra only has one other option. It's 512 gigs of storage and 16 gigs of RAM. So they trimmed the number of SKUs considerably this year. And by using the same storage and base RAM in every single phone, you know, that helps on the internal components as well.
Yeah, I mean, there's also the reality that designing these phones for the US and Japan separately from the rest of the world is still a thing that Samsung is going to have to do for a long time. And we're talking about the fact that the Galaxy S20 Plus and Ultra support both millimeter wave and sub-6 5G in the US and Japan, the only two markets where millimeter wave is even a thing. And then the rest of the world, it's just sub-6 all the time. With the smaller S20, because of the size of the phone and the fact that the millimeter wave antennas, you have to have two of them for diversity, and they're relatively large, right? They're small objectively, but for a phone, to fit them into the edge of a device, they're pretty large and they take up significant amounts of space. So Samsung couldn't design the smaller S20 with millimeter wave out of the box, but Verizon has said that it will offer a millimeter wave version in Q2. I don't know whether that means it will forego sub-6 in favor of millimeter wave only, which would be a bad idea. But very because bad. Verizon doesn't actually offer sub-6 5G right now, that's my understanding, is that they will do that for people who just want a 5G signal on a small Galaxy S20.
And that seems like the kind of thing that Verizon would do, but it's also just like, why are you bothering with this? I mean, sell the Plus and the Ultra. You don't have a sub-6 network, just like let it go.
I don't think it's for the customers.
Yeah, well, I know.
Yeah, like they're it definitely
never is.
It's just so that they can have it. They can say that they have it. And
because I understand it would be very dumb of them to offer the S20 as an LTE only phone when the Plus and the Ultra have millimeter wave. Right. But just don't offer it. I don't know. That's it's going to be a thing though, because the other carriers do have, you know, will have all three. So
I mean, we should mention this is the week, the day that the Samsung Unpacked event happened. The night before, we got word that T-Mobile and Sprint would be allowed to merge. A federal judge would release a decision the following morning, saying that basically because Sprint was so terrible, T-Mobile is saving the company rather than
Sprint so bad. It's not diminishing. We're not going to go through this whole regulatory thing,
right? Like we're not diminishing competition because Sprint is not providing any competition, right? There's a systemic problem with Sprint as a company, and therefore, even if we were to put the kibosh on this merger, Sprint would still not attract new customers because the company is so poorly run and the network is so bad. So the only way to save Sprint is to allow them to merge with T-Mobile. And that is a weird take, but I guess it's a take. So all this came out around the time that the carriers were announcing their Galaxy S20 decisions, offering 5G on all the devices. And Samsung is pretty proud of the fact that all of the Galaxy S20s are 5G enabled out of the box, and that you really don't have to think about it. If you want to buy a phone, it'll support 5G. If you have a 5G plan, it'll just work. If you don't, it'll fall back to LTE, period.
And look, that makes sense. And like they do deserve some praise for that. I mean, this little issue between the S20 and S20 Plus with millimeter wave is like you said, only a thing here in Japan. That's so everywhere else, it's just going to be like, okay, well, you just get 5G, and that's really good. And the prices are high. And I pointed this out the weekend before the S20 launched. Like all of these phones are going to be expensive. Everything that has 5G this year is going to be more expensive by a couple hundred dollars than it was last year, even if everything else stayed the same.
Right.
I mean, just the value here is pretty good if you put any value on 5G, considering look at what the V50, is that what it's called, the LG one?
Yeah,
V50 5G costs, what the OnePlus 7T Pro McLaren Edition 5G costs, what the Galaxy S10 5G, Note 10 Plus 5G, they all cost about $200 more than their 4G counterparts. Nothing else changed. Just add 5G, it's $200 more. So when you look at these phones, the S20 lineup being $200, you know, each higher than their counterparts last year, it just makes sense.
What's interesting, though, and this is the last thing we'll say about the S20, all of the phones technically have the word or letters 5G appended to them, but none of the marketing says, or none of the marketing points that out. Like, they're not saying Galaxy S20 Ultra 5G in the commercials and stuff, but if you look at the logo, 5G is on the end of every one of these phones.
Yeah.
So it's just, it's implicit. It's not as in your face as like the differentiation between the S10 and Note 10 series and their 5G counterparts, which were different phones altogether, more expensive, blah, blah, blah. So what's interesting, Andrew, is that alongside the S20 announcement, Samsung said that it was going to keep the S10 series alive and drop its price by $150 each.
Yeah. Yeah, so that puts the S10e to 600, right?
Yeah, 600.
And then S10 Plus, 750. And, or sorry, S10 750, S10 Plus, 850.
Yeah, so here's the thing, right? Like, if you were looking for an unlocked Samsung phone during Black Friday or Prime Day or whatever, you probably could have gotten the phones at those prices anyway. But now this is the MSRP, which means that you will likely be able to find them for much less if you wait a few weeks. So the Galaxy S10e at $600 is a pretty good deal. A Galaxy S10e at $500 or $450, which is what it'll inevitably get to in a few weeks, is a great deal. It's a really, really good deal. And
yeah, and I think there's particularly good deal on the S10 Plus end as well. If you shave 150 off of that or so, and it starts to get into the low 700s, high 600s.
Right. So I would say, like, if you don't need the camera improvements of the S20 series, if that's not a priority for you, the S10 series is still a really good bet. And, you know, I just updated my note. I opened my S9, turned it on just to see where it was at in terms of updates. It's on the January 2020 patch. It's still on Android 9, but it's on the 2020 security patch, and it should be getting Android 10 in a few weeks. I think all the US carriers have updated their S9 series phones to Android 10 already. So, like, you're not going to be waiting a ton of time to get Android 11 on the S10 if you're thinking about buying a phone that's already a year old.
Right.
It'll definitely get Android 11. It'll get it after the S20 series. But, you know, if updates are a priority too, then you can think about it that way too. Okay, let's take a quick break to thank a sponsor, and we will be right back. This episode of the Android Central podcast is brought to you by Indeed.com. When you start your hiring process, you may have questions. Will you find good applicants to choose from? What about education and experience? And how will you know you've made the right hire? Indeed is here to help. Millions of great candidates use Indeed every day to find their next opportunity. You can post a job in minutes and use screener questions to help create your shortlist of applicants fast. Also, add skills tests to your job posts so you can be confident in your applicants' abilities. Their library of more than 50 skill tests range from industry-specific skills like accounting to general aptitude tests like critical thinking. Indeed gives you the smart tools to make hiring decisions quickly and to be confident that you're making the right hire for your team. Post your job today at Indeed.com/ACP and get a free sponsored job upgrade on your first posting. That's Indeed.com/ACP. Terms, conditions, and exclusions apply. Offer valid until March 31st, 2020. All right, so Andrew, this week was not without drama. We had, obviously, Samsung Unpacked, and throughout the whole rigmarole, there's this coronavirus, COVID-19, now that's the official name, concern around MWC, which would have started officially 10 days from now, on February 24th. But as we all know, MWC and all these other trade conferences, they don't actually start on the day that they start. They start about 5 days before, when all of the pre-briefings begin. We were all set to leave on February 19th to get to Barcelona for February 20th. And one by one, you know, it started with LG, and Ericsson and NVIDIA and all these other companies. And then, like Domino's, many, many, many other companies dropped out. And eventually, 2 days ago, the GSMA, which runs the MWC conference, said, we're packing it in. We are not hosting a conference this year for safety reasons. We want to make sure that all of our attendees are safe and healthy, and we don't want to risk bringing any infection into the FIRA conference center. So there will be no conference at all this year. That was a major, major blow.
A crazy blow. Yeah.
Everything. Like, from the people attending, obviously, to the companies that plan their entire year around MWC. We're not just talking about the big guys, too. We're talking about, like, the tiny, tiny companies that really, really put all of their marketing dollars behind their booths and their pre-briefings and all of the stuff that goes into MWC. And the city of Barcelona is losing approximately, like, I think it was hundreds of millions of dollars in incoming revenue from attendees. So
yeah,
just a massive blow.
And those smaller companies are the ones, like you said, that are they're the most affected. Other big name brands, the ones that you could name, they are going to be, you know, they're going to be able to pivot their marketing strategies, and they'll be able to release their devices in a less optimal, but, you know, different way, and they'll be able to figure it out. It's all of the smaller companies that are going to struggle from this. And as I pointed out in my article that went up this morning to kind of wrap up, you know, who's affected by this, it's also the kind of business end of things. The thing that we don't, you know, we in the consumer facing side don't always think about is the GSMA represents everyone in the mobile industry, all the way down to, you know, antenna makers and chipset makers and carriers and, you know, backhaul service providers and everybody like that. That it's not a flashy business. It's not a big splashy thing that requires marketing budgets and all that sort of stuff. Shows like MWC is where their business gets done. Like, that's where their partner meetings are and where they're talking about all these strategies. And when you go into the back of the FIRA Convention Center, there's a keynote like every hour and a half with some telecom executive that's talking about, you know, their 5G deployment, and the room is packed full of people, and you would never have any idea that that thing is going on. Those are the things that, like, are really getting missed out on this show, even though it's not something that we report on.
And, you know, from our perspective, right there, Android is not central to MWC in the sense that Google doesn't have a huge announcement agenda there. There's always something. There's an area outside the, you know, between some of the halls at the FIRA in Barcelona where Google hosts this like village where you can go and, you know, try to earn free pins, and they make it a really fun event. But Google doesn't have a massive presence there. It's mainly the, you know, MWC technically represents a lot of the European interests when it comes to telecom. But it also represents just the fact that there's so much behind-the-scenes stuff from a network perspective that has to happen for your phones to work properly. And that is, it's not like these products are not going to come out this year. It's not like these announcements are not eventually going to happen. But everybody is going to have to pivot and make a decision about how to best get their message out there. Because one thing that you can take for granted at a trade show like this is that, you know, companies like us will write about your product because there's an expectation that people are interested in what's happening around the Mobile World Congress infrastructure. And they won't be able to take that for granted with, you know, just coming out with these announcements separately. And that's really unfortunate for companies, as I said, that base their entire year around putting their products out during Mobile World Congress.
Yeah, it certainly lowers the barrier for a lot of these announcements to get covered. And they get a lot more, you know, they get swept up in the general understanding that, well, everybody's here, and so you're going to cover everything that's there. And so a lot of times you're getting outsized coverage on a lot of things that otherwise, you know, wouldn't warrant their own launch events or, you know, things like that. It's small companies, but it's also big companies that are doing smaller, you know, less, you know, groundbreaking announcements too. And it just means that those things are going to come out in just like press releases, a regular like digital media push, and then they'll just go out and they'll be on sale in a few weeks. You know, that's just a little less splashy, even if that's what they maybe deserved in the first place. But it's frustrating because then we don't get to answer questions for anybody that's trying to, you know, interested in these things or looking to buy them, because we couldn't, you know, just walk over to that hall or, you know, take that meeting around MWC and go see the things. It's a lot harder for us to round them up and find them later as well.
So there are lingering questions about whether this should have happened, whether this was the GSMA giving into fear mongering. You know, there may be a xenophobic element to this, and the fact that there were no confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Barcelona at the time of the cancellation. Were they being too cautious or overly cautious? Were they giving into to, you know, people who were really just amplifying the message of the potential disastrous effects, or were they just being prudent?
I mean, I wrote in my article this morning again that it didn't even matter. At the point that they finally canceled, the GSMA, like, their decision was made for them. All of these companies, rightly or wrongly, in their own, you know, in their own decisions, chose to pull out because of these fears or, you know, whatever logistical problems it was going to cause for their people and their stuff. And at that point, the GSMA had to just pull it, because the show was going to be half or less than half the size that it was, you know, that it normally is. And at that point, you could argue that it would be a bigger disaster than if you just call it off.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, there weren't a lot of companies still standing. By the end of it, it was basically the Chinese OEMs, Huawei, Oppo, Vivo. And then Vivo dropped out, and I think it was, I think Xiaomi dropped out. Was it, I think Xiaomi dropped out after the cancellation, though.
So,
you know, if you think about it, right, it was Oppo, Xiaomi, and Huawei that were the lone holdouts when it came to, you know, devices. And, you know, it's telling that they were Chinese companies that were really just trying to stick it out, saying like, hey, we've done the due diligence, right? Because the GSMA, before the cancellation, put a statement out saying that anybody coming from China would have to go through a 2-week quarantine period outside the country just to make sure that they weren't traveling with and transmitting the virus. A lot of the executives for these Chinese companies were already doing that preemptively. They were somewhere else.
A month earlier.
And they knew that this was going to happen. So they wanted to go ahead with it because they were already putting in the time. And this disruption on every part of the tech, you know, the tech industry has been so thoroughly disrupted by now that this was the one remaining way that these companies could get their announcements out. And that's not going to happen now. So it is really unfortunate. But I do wonder, you know, a lot of people are saying the GSMA did this, and they've lost the confidence of the overall, you know, not only the press but the actual telecom community, and that they won't be able to host an MWC in Barcelona next year, and that this is the end of MWC as it stands, because companies will not trust it to go ahead, and they, after putting in so much money, and they'll just go out and do their own announcements. What do you think that'll happen?
No, I don't think that it will. I think that it's definitely going to have to proceed with much more caution next year. And this will be a thing that, you know, they clearly didn't plan for or have a contingency set up for. And they absolutely will for next year. But I think the MWC had gained so much importance in the mobile industry, no matter what part of it you were in, you know, the consumer side or the enterprise business side, that to just give that up for next year seems completely silly, because it's, you still have like all of that business still needs to get done, and you're not going to be able to just prop up another show and just make it happen somewhere else. That's just not really how it works. And I think the GSMA is such a powerful organization that, sure, it may, you know, put a damper on things next year, but I would be shocked if they didn't continue to go forward with it. And everything up to this point indicates that the GSMA and the city of Barcelona were both extremely happy with their overall agreement and what it did for the city and for the group and for the show, that, you know, this was out of the GSMA's hands. Like I said, they didn't make, you know, they made this decision really late because they clearly wanted to go on with it no matter what. And I think that they're going to do the same for next year.
Right. I agree with you. I don't think that there will, it may be a smaller show, and it may have fewer big announcements, or companies will sort of hedge and announce beforehand and then do like a public announcement at MWC.
Right.
Which, you know, Samsung does that now every year. So they have their Unpacked before the event, and then at the show floor they show off all of the products, right? And it's a lot of people see those products for the first time at MWC. So right, that is a good strategy. If you have the scale to do that, I think that's what companies will end up doing. The show will, it has to go on. I agree with you. So it'll be interesting to see the fallout from this, but honestly, it was sad. Like we had to cancel our trip. We are not going to Barcelona. We had to eat a bunch of money from flights and bookings, and a lot of other companies are in the same boat. They invested a lot of money in their travel plans, and I just feel bad for everybody involved, from the vendors to,
it's really unfortunate,
to the transportation and the accommodation. Everybody who's out a lot of money in Barcelona, I'm sending my thoughts, because it's going to be a tough road ahead.
And hot tip for anybody out there that's looking for a last minute vacation next week, Barcelona is a perfect place to go get a really cheap hotel.
Yeah, there are 5-star hotels for like $150 a night right now. And honestly, the reason I love going to Barcelona, it's a great city, and it's, the weather is amazing around this time of year. So I would definitely recommend that. All right, let's talk quickly about Huawei, because there's just been so much going on. We wanted to talk about it a bit last week, but we didn't have time. So we'll go back to the last couple of weeks, and then end with what's been going on this week. We heard that, you know, Huawei was really trying to move ahead with this idea of the Huawei mobile services replacing Google mobile services in its phones. It's trying to essentially figure out a way to bring apps to a non-Google ecosystem, right? So if Huawei is going to continue to release phones in the West, it needs a way to replace the apps and make available the apps that people want and download from the Google Play Store. So there are a couple of options. One is that it's just going to partner with companies like Facebook and a lot of, you know, Uber and a lot of these companies to just pre-install apps on their phones, right? So if there are,
great,
if there's like a bundle of apps that you download every time you get a new phone, Huawei will just pre-install a bunch of them, and maybe that'll be better. So some people may think it's bloatware. Other people may think, well, this is just avoiding the problem of me having to seek out these apps in the first place. The other thing that they did is they formed this organization called the Global Developer Service Alliance with Xiaomi, Oppo, and Vivo.
Had to be an alliance.
And what it is, it's not an app store. So when it first came out, we thought that this was a separate app store that the companies were all partnering on to make it easier for vendors to upload their APKs. This is not what it is. It's a centralized back end, which allows companies in North America and Europe to upload their APKs to these Chinese OEMs' individual stores. So what?
Because all of these companies operate their own app store inside of China because the Play Store is not there.
Exactly. Yeah. So Oppo and Vivo are owned by the same company, but they have their own app stores. Xiaomi has the Mi Store, and then Huawei obviously has the App Gallery. And this is just an SDK that would make it easier to distribute apps and then keep them updated, so that there wouldn't be so much overhead for companies having to update their apps on, you know, five different app stores or whatever, which I think is quite a good idea.
As far as this issue goes, yeah, it does help streamline that process, because Google doesn't give them another option. They're not allowed to ship the Play Store in China, so they already kind of have to do this. There's nothing subversive about this at all, and there's nothing, I don't think anybody's indicating that this would be like a break of Google's, you know, contracts or anything like that, because all these, Huawei aside at this point, all these companies do ship phones with the Play Store elsewhere in some capacity. Anything that can work to help streamline that process is good. You know, whether or not it's actually going to make a difference when, you know, in light of what Huawei is trying to do with its Huawei mobile services and expanding its app store outside of China, I don't think it's really going to make that much of a dent.
Yeah, and just to be clear, this is not aimed at North America or even most of Europe. It's aimed at 9 countries right now, including regions like India, Indonesia, Russia, and Malaysia. So places where the Google Play Store is available, but there isn't an entrenchment of Google services in the way that there are in North America, right? Most of these countries have local alternatives to Google services. So Android has by far the majority market share in those countries, but Google itself is not a monopoly the way that they are in North America. So I think that's a smart move. So that was one thing. And then we've heard that, you know, Huawei has been shoring up against, an impending ban in the U.S., an outright ban. The district of the company has been awaiting an indictment by the U.S. government, and that happened yesterday. So the Department of Justice actually sent down an indictment. Basically it was a RICO indictment, a racketeering and fraud charges. It's 16 counts of, let me just read the press release. The new charges in this case relate to the alleged decades-long efforts by Huawei and several of its subsidiaries, both in the U.S. and in the People's Republic of China, to misappropriate intellectual property, including from 6 U.S. technology companies, in an effort to grow and operate Huawei's business. The misappropriated intellectual property included trade secret information and copyrighted work, such as source code and user manuals from internet routers, antenna technology, and robot testing technology. Huawei U.S. and FutureWay, which is a subsidiary of Huawei, agreed to reinvest the proceeds of this alleged racketeering activity in Huawei's worldwide business, including in the United States. And there's a separate charge that alleges that Meng Wanzhou, the former CFO and the daughter of Huawei's founder, who is currently on trial in Canada, awaiting extradition to the U.S. for what ended up being these charges. They allege that they're a subsidiary of Huawei, breached U.S. sanctions against Iran and North Korea by providing intellectual property and hardware to companies in those regions.
That's what ZTE got in trouble for.
Yes, very big trouble. The ZTE got in such big trouble that they temporarily had to basically shut down because they didn't have access to any U.S. companies. Now, Huawei obviously is in the same boat. ZTE's ban was lifted, but this is the official charge. So this is what we've been waiting for, right? Like the Department of Justice has been putting together this indictment for months. I mean, obviously Meng Wanzhou was arrested in December 2018, and she's not yet extradited. right? So she's still, the trial is still going on in Canada. She will be extradited. I mean, there's no question. Canada has to extradite her. But when she gets extradited, she will be a member of this indictment, right? She will be part of it. But Huawei as a company is also part of the indictment. It's interesting because this is separate from the fact that the U.S. government is actually trying to ban Huawei entirely from the country, which they haven't done yet. I mean, that would surprise you because they're not, really not allowed to do anything in the U.S. right now. But they're not banned outright.
They just can't work with any U.S. companies. So it's effectively the same thing.
Yeah.
Currently.
Okay, so that has been Huawei. Huawei released a statement today saying, for quite a while, the U.S. government has been using the strength of an entire nation to come after a private company. It has used every tool at its disposal, whether they be legislative, administrative, judicial, or diplomatic, and has even tried to turn public opinion against Huawei to disrupt our normal business operations. Rarely has this kind of attack been seen before in history. The U.S. Department of Justice's new charges against Huawei are part of this campaign. This is political persecution, plain and simple. Lots of plosives in that, in that paragraph. The charges are nothing new. They don't reveal anything new. They're based largely on resolved civil disputes from the last 20 years that have been previously settled, litigated, and in some cases rejected by federal judges and juries. Okay, so this is now what Huawei's contending with. And then, separate from this, which is bananas, the Wall Street Journal released an exclusive saying that last year, the U.S. government unclassified documents and showed them to intelligence officials in Germany and the UK, proving or claiming to have proof that Huawei has installed backdoors in its telecom equipment since 2009. So 11 years. Now we knew that previously Germany had seen documents like this. We just didn't know that they were actually unclassified documents from the US government, which is insane to me that this happened. And what it says is that, like, yes, obviously the US does not want Huawei equipment on its networks, but it also is doing everything it can to discourage other countries from allowing Huawei on its 5G networks. We didn't really mention earlier, but a couple of weeks ago, the British government said that it would allow up to 35% of its 5G network to include Huawei equipment. It just wouldn't be available on the core. So none of the technology that is used to pass through really sensitive public emergency data, things like that, that will not use Huawei equipment, but they will allow Huawei to be part of their networks. Canada is now mulling the same thing, whether it will allow Huawei to be used in its 5G networks. Yesterday, one of Canada's top big three carriers said that it would use Huawei equipment primarily for its 5G rollout, one of the only to do so. That was TELUS. Rogers is using Ericsson and Bell is using Nokia. So it's really interesting seeing what's happening. But basically, if that happens, the Canadian government is going to come under just absurd amounts of scrutiny from the U.S. government, and there's going to be repercussions there. Anyway, long story short, Huawei is effed. Like, there's really no way to put it.
I mean, it doesn't even matter that up to this point, there are previous investigations by the US and UK governments that didn't find any wrongdoing or any backdoors, even when they're actively looking for them. So that's just what's crazy about this report from the Journal, is just how much they contradict each other in the span of just a couple of years.
Absolutely. I mean, so what's interesting is that, yes, the U.S. government unclassified documents allegedly prove that Huawei has installed backdoors, but these are not public documents and they probably never will be. So we don't have access to any of this information. We know that Huawei has not been as scrupulous as it could have been in some parts of the world, right? There have been Huawei equipment that was allegedly used. Like they didn't shut down a Telnet service on some of its network equipment that could have been used for spying. But really, like, there has been no public evidence, so we have to say that outright. All this is to say, Huawei is not in a good place right now, but it's soldiering on, and it will release new phones in the spring. We know that the P40 and P40 Pro are going to be announced. We know that the company is still the largest telecom provider, network equipment telecom provider, and that is probably not going to change. And the company is making a ton of money without the U.S. So, yeah, this is not going away.
No, I don't think it will. And obviously, I mean, Huawei isn't going to be put out of business by not being able to operate in the U.S. and U.K., but it could. I mean, they have to fight this really, really, really hard here because they don't want it to turn into a cascade where they get worked all the way back to just providing equipment in, you know, the greater China area of influence.
So before we sign off for the week, there was some breaking news as we were reporting. A YouTube channel, Front Page Tech, released an alleged render of an alleged Pixel 5 prototype. And hoo boy, this thing is ugly. Just,
oh man, I haven't looked at this yet.
Just like, look at this live, because I want to get your reaction. Apparently, this is based on CAD designs for one of three potential Pixel 5 designs. So this is not a final design by any means, and it's probably going to change because it's not good.
Oh man, what? There's no way.
Yeah, I know, but
it looks very surprised.
Yes, it does look surprised. I would be very surprised if this ended up being what the Pixel 5 looks like. Head to AndroidCentral.com if you haven't seen it already, or just Google Pixel 5 because this is going to be everywhere for the next couple of days. Let us know what you think about the rumored Pixel 5 design. And you can do that at podcast@AndroidCentral. We love hearing from you. We will sign off now, let you get back to your Valentine's Day plans. Or by the time you listen to this, I hope you had a great Valentine's Day, actually. Andrew, thanks for getting up early for this. I appreciate it.
Oh, no problem at all. I'm here for it anytime.
All right, sounds good. We'll do it earlier and earlier every week.
Oh, man, that's going to backfire on you.
Yeah, I know. Trust me. All right, that's it. We will be back next week with more Android and Google hot takes. Thank you so much for listening. Send your best wishes to Jerry. He's not feeling great. At him on Twitter, if you wouldn't mind, @GBHill. He would love to hear from you. You can find Andrew @AndrewMartinick. You can find me @JourneyDan. You can find all of us at Android Central. Have a great week. Bye-bye.
Bye.